Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Alison Edwards, a lecturer at Bath Spa University in the UK and an expert on Russian militarism, youth, memory, and patriotic education. In other words, the ideal guest for today, for May 9th, which Russia celebrates as Victory Day. Welcome, Dr. Edwards, and thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
All right, it's great to have you on the podcast, first-time guest, and I think it's a great occasion for this. My first question is about the history of the Kremlin's use of Victory Day in general and the Red Square military parade in particular for purposes of propaganda and signaling both to Russian and foreign audiences. I don't know about Britain, but from my experience living in Russia through much of the 1990s and 2000s, I think it's fair to say that World War II looms substantially larger in the minds of many Russians than it does in the minds of many Americans for a number of good reasons. But one reason, and I think this applies particularly since Putin came to power more than 20 years ago, is the emphasis that the state puts on it with the elaborate military parade on Red Square on May 9th as the centerpiece. Now, this is a broad question, Dr. Edwards, but before we get to this year's parade, the commemoration of a war that ended 78 years ago, while the war Russia launched against Ukraine is causing death and destruction daily, I wonder if you could speak before that a little bit about the history of these ceremonies and how the Kremlin has used them through the years or the decades.
Yes, thank you for this question. I think that's a really important point, actually, that the context really helps us understand where we are today in terms of how Russia kind of manages its memory landscape. I think that, you lived in Russia, as you said, in the 1990s and 2000s, and that's kind of the 1990s particularly is some of the research is some of kind of the main research I did as part of my PhD, and I focused on this commemoration of the Great Patriotic War. And I think that the main thing I want to talk about first is, you know, where these traditions come from, the tradition of not just the Great Patriotic War in general, but the use of the military parade. And don't worry, I'm not going to kind of take us into this long history of Russia from its beginning. But I do think that a lot of the times when we're speaking about what's taking place in Russia today, particularly in terms of how Russia memorializes the Great Patriotic War, we kind of attribute a lot of this to Putin. You know, Putin has added his own personality, I'll say, to the way that Russia celebrates the Soviet victory. But I think that a lot of it is Putin dressing something that's already existed. You know, the framework has existed for some time. And I think this is across maybe three or four areas in which we can focus. The first one I would say continues using the parades in general, using the parades as a way of commemorating and celebrating parts of history that Russia celebrates, but also using it in society more generally. And what I'm thinking about here is really the tradition of military ceremony in Russia, dating as far back to Imperial Russia. You know, the parades that we see on Red Square, while they are specific, you know, in choreography and the messaging to the Great Patriotic War, the actual use of the military parade as a form of memorialization, celebration, and as a showcasing of power was actually used much, much before. There was an exercise of power that was probably the kind of the central element for why the imperial leaders used it. But this element proves true to the Russian state's kind of continued use of the parade today. You know, why use parades? What are their utility, or what is its utility? Surely kind of a wreath on the tomb of the unknown soldier, history lessons in classes and museums are enough. But not for Russia. And I think this is partly because a parade is a huge declaration of Russian power, or what it hopes to declare. You know, it hopes to show itself as a power on a global stage. I think that this is particularly true. This was particularly true in 1945, the first actual Victory Day parade dedicated to the Great Patriotic War. It was coming out of the Second World War. Leaders of the Soviet Union wanted to declare their superpower status, and they did this in such a grand way. What we see now, particularly from commentators, especially, you know, us sitting on the outside of Russia looking in, is a concentration on kind of whether the Russia is a superpower and whether the parades themselves are a showcasing of this power, and whether that power can be reflected in these parades. So a lot of the discussions you'll see today, and as before in previous years, is around, you know, how many tanks are on Red Square, how many people are on Red Square, what type of speech has Putin given? Is it showing Russian power? And you'll find this in lots of commentary about the Great Patriotic War and the Victory Day parades in general. There's a focus on that power, and that's something that Putin's adopted from leaders before him in the Soviet Union, who decided to choose him as a parade as a way of showcasing and celebrating the Great Patriotic War. But he's taken it to this new level. And I think this is kind of where we can then look at the second aspect, the second aspect I wanted to focus on kind of at the start, which is the cult of the Great Patriotic War victory. We now see this as kind of insane, over the top memorializations of the Great Patriotic War, not necessarily in the kind of remembrance of the war itself, but in, for example, the dressing up of young children in army gear and sitting in prams that have been decorated as if they were tanks. And this is something that I would say is more general of the Putin era, that kind of hyperbolic celebration of Victory Day parade. But the actual cult of the Great Patriotic Victory itself was born in the Brezhnev era. And a lot of people kind of attribute that to Brezhnev himself, in the sense that, you know, he was not he was so young when the October Revolution took place. And what he did during his time in office was kind of centered the Great Patriotic War, because he felt like he was also centering himself as someone who was a veteran of the Great Patriotic War into the celebrations itself. And what he did during that time was kind of maneuvered the interest and identity of the Soviet Union from the October Revolution itself, which still existed and people still kind of memorialize it today, but centered it more so on that Great Patriotic War victory. And it, you know, one of the things that we can talk about is, and I won't do this in much depth, but during the Soviet period itself, national huge parades that we see today in Russia only took place on big anniversary dates. The first being 1945, the second being 1965, 1985 was the third one, and then in 1990, just before the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. So it was during the 1960s, and that 1965 parade itself, that the cult of that great victory was formed, that idea of the Great Patriotic War as something that should be central to Russia's, the Soviet Union during that time, the Soviet Union's identity. And I don't know, this might be something that you experienced yourself, but when we moved into the 1990s, the victory parades themselves kind of ceased to exist until 1995, until the 50th anniversary of the Great Patriotic War. And this was something that was actually, and this was something I explored in my PhD, it was a huge talking point in the political discussions of the time. 1995, lots of people in the State Duma, including Yeltsin themselves, wanted to reposition the Soviet victory as a Russian victory, right? So what they were doing in 1995 was they were framing a victory of a now basically collapsed empire and trying to reframe it into relevance. And Yeltsin did this by Russifying the memory in Russia's physical landscape. So they created the Moscow's Victory Museum, for example, which included kind of religious tropes to showcase a departure from the Soviet past. But the parade itself on Red Square remained largely untouched. And I think it's because that itself was kind of sacred. Now, there's two things that I should mention here. There were two parades in 1995, one of which was on Poklonaya Gora, and one of which was on Red Square. The one on Red Square remains pretty much as we see it today. But they had veterans rather than younger military cohorts. And then on Poklonaya Gora, you had the exact same kind of choreography taking place, but with younger cohorts. So those the students of the cadet courts, for example, they were playing this role of the glorious dead. And what we see, however, with that, with the celebrations from 1945 to 1965 to 1985, 1990 and 1995, is the same choreography. We see the same Soviet paraphernalia. We're seeing the same process. So I don't really know how to explain this, apart from, you know, in 1945, we had General Zhukov, for example, on horseback going to each faction or each unit and congratulating them, just as today we have Sergei Shoigu in his car going to each faction and congratulating them for their victory in the Great Patriotic War. So a lot of the things have stayed the same. And what we're seeing kind of with Putin today is adding to traditions that have already existed, adding to that in a definitely a more extreme way through, as I said earlier, the hyperbolic kind of memorializations of the victory cult. There's kind of a quick outline of the history of those Victory Day parades, but it kind of paints a picture of Putin's not kind of the, he's not the manufacturer of what we see today, but what he's done is he's renovated it and he's added to it. And I'm sure there will be plenty of people in the Soviet Union and even in Russia, it's in the Soviet Union, oh my gosh, in Russia and in countries that were part of the Soviet Union, who will now kind of be looking at the use of this great victory as with dismay and with disappointment, definitely from the state.
Absolutely. That's fascinating history. A lot of things I didn't know. I'll just point to a couple of things kind of that your words made me think of. I think you mentioned the idea of Brezhnev kind of moving away from the history of the revolution and kind of turning more toward the victory in the Second World War as a focal point. And of course, Putin in fact has been very critical of Lenin, and so for him, I think it's that's kind of a natural thing that he would want to continue with the idea that this is the moment of greatness, not the revolution, which he calls Lenin put a time bomb under the country, things like that. Another thing, but just to segue, I guess, to discussion of, and I do remember. Thanks. My memory is actually not that great, but I do remember that, there weren't really parades for part of the 90s, and then there's one. What I'm trying to remember is whether there was kind of, I feel like in the 2000s was the first time that they again returned, weapons like machinery, tanks and such to Red Square. But I'm not sure. I do recall, of course, in the 2000s, missiles being standing around in central Moscow in the days before the parade, just to, and that kind of makes me think of what you say about, in the West, most people think maybe laying a wreath is enough or, that sort of thing. It's sort of not the same, at least for the Russian state. Now, another thing you mentioned is the way this parade and I guess others, before the Soviet era, been used as a projection of power, and in the context of today's events and today's Red Square parade, I just wanted to ask about that because it seemed like, I think people are noticing that there was less military material than there had been in previous years. I don't really recall last year very much, but with the war in Ukraine, whether it's security concerns or the fact that, in fact, a lot of military equipment has been destroyed, or well, people might think, why do you have them? Why are you parading them on Red Square? They should be at the front. But for whatever reason or reasons, there was less of that. There was no aviation, no jets kind of screaming overhead. So I think to some degree it was, at least superficially, less of a projection of power than it has been in the past, which may be kind of paradoxical given the fact that Russia is in this war of aggression that it started. But I guess I'll use that as a way to ask the second question, which is more about today's parade. This is, of course, as I mentioned, the second time that this anniversary, the May 9th, has come around since Putin launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. And the war and what has become, in fact, the largest war in Europe since World War II. Really the war that Russia launched is surreal in many horrifying ways. It's the 21st century. Russia's killing tens of thousands of people and destroying cities in an unprovoked assault on its neighbor. This is happening now, and yet Putin and the Kremlin are celebrating victory in a war that ended almost 80 years ago. Allison, is there anything that stood out for you as different or somehow significant in this year's ceremonies, in the military parade or in Putin's speech, for example? I guess anything that provides real clues about intentions or, whether in terms of Ukraine or the West or the Russian populace?
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for your commentary then. There were so many things that you mentioned then that I've just been thinking, oh, I want to kind of jump in and say something about that. So I'm just going to talk about some of those points you made really quickly. And, the point you made about, why is this equipment here and not on the front? And people will be asking that question. I think they're asking probably the right questions. They're asking the right questions of the Russian state, given that, Russia has incurred significant losses during the start of the this newer invasion of Ukraine. But I also think that's probably a result as well also of the fact that people aren't hearing these things unless they have access to VPN, for example, because the state is kind of keeping control over these narratives. I also think the other thing that you've mentioned here is, people in Russia will be looking at this parade and wondering why there isn't such a great show of power. If we think of power in terms of people on Red Square, and if we think of power as well in terms of actual vehicle count, because this year, so I think it was something like 2021 or 2020, there were 14,000 troops on Red Square, so standing on Red Square, and this year they're counting between 8,000 and 10,000. So there's quite a significant amount less than only 2 years ago. And that was even more so in terms of the vehicles at dawn. So I was looking at analyses of the parade earlier and saw that there was 197 vehicles used in the 2021 Victory Day parade, but today only around 51. And one of those, only one of them being an actual tank. And actually some of them were also taken from Chechnya. I think that really, given that Russia lives in this particular perpetual narrative that it is under constant kind of, it is consistently vulnerable to outside forces, you'd think that they would take into consideration in previous, previous parades, not to put all of their troops or all of their vehicles out there. Given the fact that if they then do go to war, they need to give some of those the troops, plus the vehicles, plus the military hardware for the actual war effort, and also to kind of show the society that they're living in that there's still a sort of stability, a calm, that they are in control of the situation, which this parade doesn't necessarily show. In terms of the actual question you've asked me, there are a few things that stood out, but they weren't particularly different. The thing that stood out to me the most was definitely the lack of people and military hardware on the actual Red Square itself, which, as I said, that would have been what people were looking out for today. That would have been a lot of what the commentators were looking for. The second thing for me is that the Immortal Regiment is a pivotal part of the Victory Day celebrations. The Immortal Regiment themselves, for anyone who's not kind of in the know on this part, they're a regiment that was set up in Tomsk originally about 12 years ago now. So the Tomsk itself is a city just about 4 hours north of Novosibirsk. And it's a very small city, but it has like a huge, I guess, following for the Great Patriotic War. I mean, in the sense that it has this huge memorial in Tomsk itself and has actual museums for such as well. But yeah, so the Immortal Regiment kind of started there. And what will happen is that normally people will march with pictures of their loved ones who were lost in the war. And if you are someone who didn't have a relative who was actually or directly linked to the war, you can actually pick up another picture of someone else who was linked to the war. So you can also walk around with a stranger's picture and memorialize them as part of this Immortal Regiment ceremony, I would guess. But this year, that's not taking place as it normally would. So normally there would be huge marches kind of through cities holding the pictures of these of their loved ones. But this year it's being carried on in other formats, again, citing security concerns. So this is mostly online. They did this during the COVID years and also during 2021. And then the Immortal Regiment kind of came back last year. But this year now they're saying that actually they need to return back online because having people massed in a group would actually make Ukraine more likely to attack. This is what they're saying. I think that at the same time, however, I do wonder, you know, given the desire of the Immortal Regiment to go international, to have an international presence, whether online as well was a strategy of being able to include more people in the movement. So those are the two kind of physical things that struck me. But then we get to Putin's speech. I think it was pretty much a short speech, but it was full of punch. Not necessarily in what he was saying, but how he was saying it. He came across as very like angered. That's kind of the tone that I took from the speech itself. But the context were very much as expected. You know, we first kind of start off with him speaking about Russia being a savior of mankind from Nazis during the Second World War. And so what we see already is kind of Russia and Putin himself tapping into this messianic kind of and moral identity that Russia wants to tap into. He then very quickly kind of descends into this discussion on how Russia's being kind of provoked. He also refers to the West as kind of conducting a crusade against Russia. That was one of the quotes that I wrote down when I was listening to his speech, carrying out a crusade against Russia. This is the first kind of time I would say that he in this context, I would say, outlines that the West is waging a real war against Russia. But he also talks about the Western as kind of global elites, pushing exclusivity and sowing seeds of hatred. And he talks about hatred, sowing seeds of hatred, particularly in reference to, for example, traditional family values, which Russia has positioned itself as having defending or is defending, for example. The crusade against Russia by the West, by the Western global elites, as Putin has said, kind of fits more into the general framework that lives within Russian society, that Russia is vulnerable to outside forces, as I noted earlier. And that actually, you know, Russia wants to live this peaceful, free and stable life. So these were kind of ideas that I would have expected to see before I even tuned into the speech itself. And he delivered in the sense of kind of feeding into it. He kind of talks, he places Russia as kind of responsible, not just for saving mankind from Nazis in the Great Patriotic War, but also about his and people in Russia's responsibility for maintaining memories of the Great Patriotic War by outlining that memorials are being destroyed, history is being erased and desecrated with lies. These are narratives that haven't just kind of come out of Russia's most recent invasion of Ukraine in 2022. They've been around for a while. And they are ideas that have been even kind of outlined in Russia's constitution in 2020, where they outlined a historical truth clause. They basically said that it was prohibited for anyone to kind of talk about Great Patriotic War memory in any way that diminishes their success. So this is these ideas, as I said, are expected because they're not necessarily ones that have come out of the invasion of Ukraine, but they're ones that Putin has used and adapted and renovated for this year. I think one of the kind of more interesting ones, that interesting discussions that Putin brings up, or at least he kind of reiterates, is he's also using this space to speak to the Ukrainian people. That's something that I got today. He kind of speaks about the Ukrainian people as being held hostage by the state, which I think is kind of an important part of his discourse that doesn't often get attention. Because what we look at first are the hawkish ideas that he perpetuates, or his discussions about Russia being vulnerable, for example, which I've also, you know, I tend to sometimes focus on those. But also what we can see in Putin's speech is his desire to want to speak to the Ukrainian people. But also at the same time, what he's actually doing in destroying the Ukrainian people, as you said, with the large-scale invasion that they started in February 2022, means that actually his narratives possibly go unheard. People don't want to hear them because what he says is different to what he is doing. He's talking about kind of the Ukrainians being held hostage by the state, the Ukrainian state itself, without really considering, or not considering his actions. I'm sure he'd probably consider them. I don't think he's fully realizing the lack of support in Ukraine for Russia, and the kind of huge unifying force actually that this war has had on the Ukrainian people in bringing them together against Russia. From what I see in terms of Twitter, it seems that there are not as many people kind of out on the streets watching and celebrating. So I would not necessarily say this is due to like lack of support. It could be that because events can be caught online, or because people are away from the city over the holiday weekend. But another thing, and probably the last thing I'll just mention now that struck me about the parade, is the attendance of foreign dignitaries. This is not to say that this was unusual this year in comparison to last year. Last year, there were not many foreign dignitaries there either. But what we're seeing today, for example, is Lukashenko, president of Belarus. We're also seeing like the president of Armenia there, for example. We're seeing kind of he's been able to muster up support, or not even support, but the attendance of countries that were part of the Commonwealth of Independent States, which he also mentioned in his speech as well. So the actual attendance as well is showing kind of a disengagement of Russia from the West in general, and more of a pivoting, a turning from the West towards South and East of Russia itself.
All right, thanks very much. Some great points there. Just comment on a few. The last thing you mentioned, I think Putin has got to be very happy that he was able somehow to get, I think it was seven other leaders of former Soviet republics to come, all five from Central Asia, all five presidents from Central Asia, and then Pashinyan of Armenia and Lukashenko of Belarus. Just days ago, it seemed like the Kyrgyz president might be the only foreign leader there. So kind of wonder how that happened, whether it was just sort of some political calculus on their part or pressure. I'm sure there was pressure. I don't know what it was. A couple other things. You mentioned the Immortal Regiment. We had an interesting story about that last week, about the fact that it was basically canceled. And this is something that, as you mentioned, it's kind of, it began in Tomsk as a grassroots thing. And then like a few years ago, maybe in 2015, I think, or so, it was kind of co-opted by the state. And I believe Putin may have marched in it once or twice. But this year it was canceled, as you said, but, you know, they were citing security concerns. But, you know, we spoke to analysts and two other kind of potential reasons for the cancellation emerged, one of which was the fear, potential fear in the Kremlin that people would hold posters of their relatives killed in the war in Ukraine, and also just the kind of maniacal, fear or concern about large groups of people gathering in any way, really, in Russia, unless it's completely organized. So that, that definitely, as you pointed out, was a big difference, I think, from this year from previous years. And you also mentioned, his speech was kind of, as expected, lots of things. What struck me was kind of, it seemed like almost like a speech he could have made, and many of the points or false narratives that he has made in other recent speeches, like that he could have made on any occasion, not necessarily a military parade. He had the he began by saying that the West. Well, he didn't specify the West there, but that Russia is under attack. He said that once again, a real war has been unleashed against our motherland or homeland. So I think that was really, that's sort of the narrative, as you pointed out also, that's kind of one of the main narratives about the war in Ukraine. Note, they call that, the government calls that a special operation, but he has no problem suggesting that Russia is in a defensive war against the West. And just one last thing I'll mention in this connection is that to me, it seemed like over the years, Putin at these May 9th parade speeches has kind of, very often suggested or hinted that the West or the U.S. is threatening the world and Russia in a similar way that to what Nazi Germany did. In other words, threatening to try to take everything over, and that was always for years. That was kind of the level of hints. He didn't know, was he talking about Islamic State or was he talking about the U.S. But then in recent years, he's become more clear. And now today, he pretty much just said this, we're in a defensive war against the West. They're trying to take over everything and, ruin traditional values and lots of other things. So I felt like it was kind of a speech in which he was repeating his narratives, including false narratives about the war in Ukraine, but in a way that, could have happened at any speech. But anyway, I'm going to stop now and open it up to questions. So if anyone has any questions, you can. Ask for speaker privilege or otherwise. See if we have any questions that have come in. Here's a message. Okay, give it a few more moments. I don't see any questions now. Sorry, Dr. Edwards, I kind of monopolized there at the end. Do you want to respond to what I was saying, or make any other points?
Thank you, Steve. No, you didn't. Well, you didn't monopolize them. Everything you said was pretty much everything I always think when I watch these things. I'm always reflecting them, wondering, is there anything new to this? What's the difference? What am I looking at? I think I always start these Victory Day parade watchings without knowing what I'm looking for. And I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that I expect certain things from Putin, like what he says is in his speeches. But also sometimes I feel like anything can happen. I'm working with a colleague at the moment on youth militarization. We're just kind of counting, and we're off kind of we're not nowhere near finding out the total number, so please don't ask. But we're kind of counting the amount of projects that youth are being asked to participate in. You know, for example, they're being asked to draw a poster of Peter the First, for example, and submit it for a competition, or they're being asked to participate in a graffiti event where they draw graffitis of veterans of the Great Patriotic War, or they're being asked to write a letter to soldiers on the front. And we sit there sometimes and we think, gosh, there's so much here. This can't reflect a state that is, it feels secure in itself, that feels secure in what it's trying to push or perpetuate into society. When we kind of looked earlier on, just before the war began, about, you know, the main question was, will a war break out? And a lot of people who focus kind of on rational discourses in international relations were saying, well, no, it doesn't rationally make sense for Putin to actually conduct this war. But one of the things that was missing was this emotion, was this emotional aspect, this true belief that Putin has in this kind of idea, you know, the ideas he perpetuates about Ukraine belonging to Russia, for example. And Putin has such conviction in that sense in his ideas, but he's also extremely fragile in the sense that whilst he believes it, he can also sense that maybe others don't. And so what me and my colleague Dr. Jenny Mathers, just in case anyone is interested, we sit there and we sometimes wonder, you know, how chaotic is all of this? How chaotic is it to kind of live in Russia where you're being bombarded from all of these different ideas from multiple different, in multiple different ways on multiple different formats? And one of the things that I kind of noticed about Putin's speech is, yes, I expected it, but not in that order. It all felt a bit like Putin's consciousness thrown out, literally thought out 5 minutes before the actual speech took place itself. It felt very chaotic. He jumped from ideas, came back to them, revisited them. The way he spoke showed that he was kind of holding back or trying to hold back some sort of anger. And so I think one of the things that we might need to kind of keep in our minds as we continue to learn or observe Russia in terms of its current invasion of Ukraine and future victory parades and future speeches from Putin is that there doesn't seem to be a solid plan. Doesn't seem to be a solid plan. There doesn't seem to be a sense of security that the narratives that they are perpetuating, they have a sense that actually society will remain under their control. Or that society could one day believe in the narratives that they're pushing today, for example, but tomorrow they could throw that away, could suddenly start disbelieving. I don't know if any of that made sense, but I think that the speech today kind of showcased a sense of chaos. We tend to look at the actual state of the war through the vehicles, through the troops, through the strategy, but actually just looking at the speech itself and the way that Russia conducts itself in society shows a new level of chaos, a different level of chaos.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think a great point about the emotion. I mean, you mentioned, I'll try not to go on long about this, but you mentioned, you know, there was no before the invasion in February, the February 2022, the large scale invasion. You know, the argument that he wasn't going to go ahead with it was based on the idea that there was no rational reason for him to. It was bad for Russia, you know, obviously bad for everyone else, but he did, and I really have come to think that emotion, you know, is a huge part of what Putin has done, and emotion and resentment, and his, what, you know, what people call it, his ahistorical, his ideas about history that are, you know, mostly inaccurate. Whether he believes them or not, he's certainly pursuing them as if he did. So I think, you know, it's a great point to bring up the you know, the kind of predominance or the dominance of emotion in this. Obviously, it's disturbing because it means kind of everyone is at the mercy of this until it can be stopped. But also what you mentioned about chaos, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, he made his statements in a strange order, and you know, it did seem like it didn't seem very well thought out. And I think on the battlefield, you can also see that kind of chaos happening, you know, around Bakhmut. I mean, he had an idea, he had a plan. Russia was going to essentially take over, bring Ukraine to its knees within a few days or weeks, and that hasn't happened. That didn't happen, and now it's kind of ad libbing. You know, I'm not a military expert, but it's sort of like that. That's how it seems to me. So I think your points about chaos and emotion are very well taken. Okay, I will just check if there are any questions that have come in. If not, we can wrap it up. Okay, let's do so. Once again, I've been speaking to Alison Edwards, a lecturer at Bath Spa University in the UK and an expert on Russian militarism, youth, memory, and patriotic education. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. Dr. Edwards, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, it's a great conversation. I appreciate your analysis. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back next Monday for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening.